Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema for your free 30-day trial of Mubi. Go to mubi.com/filmstage.
If it doesn't have a tail, it's not a monkey. Even if it has a monkey kind of shape. If it doesn't have a tail, it's not a monkey. If it doesn't have a tail, it's not a monkey, it's an ape. If it doesn't have a tail, it's not a monkey.
Well, let's see if we can catch it on the tape.
You can very plainly see if...
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast for thefilmstage.com.
Right, was that VeggieTales?
Yeah, it is VeggieTales.
Okay.
That's... We'll get into it.
All right.
I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, we have Michael Snydell.
Good morning.
And today, we do not have Bill Graham. We have a special guest, and that is Matt Patches.
Hello.
Hello. Matt Patches, editor at Thrillist, and a co-host of Fighting in the War Room.
That's right. Yeah. Been doing that for a very, very long time. So much podcasting.
I was about to say, one of my favorite movie podcasts. So this is quite an experience for me.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, you guys are great. I will give the obligatory, you know, hatred for David just right out the gate.
I'm here to give that the whole time. Just, you ask for it, I'll deliver.
Fantastic.
I love David Ehrlich. He's very opinionated, but our show is true to the name. There's a lot of fighting.
I sometimes worry that, like, I'm the David of our group. And people on Twitter have been giving me so much shit recently that it's very possible that that's becoming the case. So... I don't know what
look
to do.
Look inward. I'll help you. I'll be the ombudsman of this podcast.
Okay, great. At the end of this podcast, you have to, like, give me a final judgment based on my reactions to War for the Planet of the Apes, whether or not you think I'm the David of the group.
Fair.
Okay. All right. That was the VeggieTales. I have never watched the VeggieTales, but this morning when I was pulling up clips and music, my wife said, or I said to my wife, I don't really know any songs that have to do with monkeys. And she said, well, what about Hey, sure. Hey, We're the Monkees? And I was going to roll with that, but then I said, you know, the problem is they're apes, not monkeys, and I know that people care about that. And she grew up in an evangelical Christian household, and so she's all about the VeggieTales, and so she told me about this wonderful VeggieTales song. So yes, Michael, I played the VeggieTales at the opening of this episode.
But aren't the VeggieTales are a world full of anthropomorphic vegetables.
Yeah.
But they still have apes. That doesn't make sense.
They have God, they have Jesus Christ, and they have apes.
Of all things for evangelical Christians to include in this world, apes would not be one of them, I would imagine. That's a shocker. They don't really subscribe to certain theories involving apes, so that's...
I mean,
I don't want to get too controversial right off the bat here, but
we strive
some
for
holes.
Controversy. In fact, we're going to pivot this entire episode purely talking about the theory of evolution versus creationism and maybe get some flat earth science in there too, because I'm still waiting for an episode where I have the opportunity to fully explain the flat earth theory to people.
Oh, no, Brian, you already tried to do this.
It's the coolest, craziest conspiracy theory that I've ever heard, and I'm sad that more people don't know about it. But
let's pretend that War for the Planet of the Apes takes place in a world that is the flat Earth theory come true. Then you can just go off.
That would be amazing. Yeah, we'll probably do that. We'll see how that goes. But yes, so we're here today to talk about War for the Planet of the Apes. Before we do that, we will be having a discussion about one of the biggest and most interesting... I hesitate to even call it an article. Things that has been published in the movie world in quite some time. And that is this list of the 100 best movie props that was published on Thrillist. A thing that took me nearly 3 days to get through in its entirety because I refused to skip a single one. Even the ones that I hadn't seen. Because I was just that wrapped up in it. If you are a film buff, a film history buff, or a film ephemera buff, this is the story for you. Before we get into that, let me remind everyone we can be found on Twitter at Film Stage Show, Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. Give us a comment and a rating on iTunes. We got a rating another rating, but no comment. So, like, I saw the number of ratings that we had tick up. I'm assuming it was a 5. I'm just going to roll with that. Because if you don't give us feedback, I can only assume that your feedback is positive. And, yeah, that's about that. We're still doing our Patreon, so go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. For as little as $1 an episode, you can get involved in our Patreon patron Slack. You will get entered into a bunch of cool movie raffles. And, of course, it'll give us the opportunity to do more episodes, even though that doesn't seem like it's possible right now, because we're already doing 2 a week, trying to catch up with the insane amount of films that are coming out right now. And we're brought to you by Mubi. Mubi is the streaming online cinema, where every day they enter a new movie onto their subscription service, and you have 30 days to watch, so you always have a rotating panel of 30 great films to check out. Not only does Mubi have a curated selection that helps you to actually choose a good movie instead of just mainlining 30 Rock again. I'm talking to myself right now because I'm in the middle of that. You can download these to your iPhone, your tablet, and watch them on the go. And not only that, but again, in the world of streaming software, Mubi has by far the prettiest and easiest to use app. So all you got to do for your free 30-day trial is go to mubi.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial of Mubi. Okay, all of that out of the way, we can now jump into the real reasons we're here. So, Patches.
Yes, sir.
This movie props list. I have a couple of questions right out of the gate on a macro scale.
It's a very, it can be discussed on a macro scale. According to an email, a roundup email of long reads that I receive every Sunday, an amazing newsletter run by ESPN's Don Van Natta Jr., the Sunday long read. Everyone should subscribe to it, but it rounds up like biggest stories and best stories of the week and, you know, long form. So, and thanks to the Pocket app, it tells you how long it takes to read those stories. Yeah. You know, you have 15 minutes. I see a 20 minute, 35 minutes. And then our story is included on it, which I was very grateful for. Pocket lists the read time as 132 minutes. Oh my God.
So about the length of your average summer blockbuster.
I wish it was the length of the average summer blockbuster. Well, no, I guess you're right. You're probably a little over. Transformers style. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, War for the Planet of the Apes was 2 hours and 19 minutes. So
this is the War of the Planet of the Apes for online entertainment journalism.
So usually when we talk about a list on this show, we do a very simple thing where we do a remove and replace type of thing. So for instance, when the Film Stage published its list of its favorite sci-fi films, we removed one and replaced it with one that we liked more. It would be nearly impossible to do that with this list. It's insanely comprehensive. So how did you people decide to do this? What was the genesis for this?
We started the entertainment section of Thrillist in November 2015. And the first email I have about the props list was in December 2015. So it's definitely taken a little while because it takes both conception, starting to talk about what the list would be, the rules of a list, I think a great list. Mm-hmm. Not only are we defining props by a property master's on-set definition, what an actor would, you know, move around in a scene, interact with something that's driving action, a hero prop that's going to be seen in a lot of different moments of the film. But we wanted to narrow the scope because I think if I had the DeLorean on here, while the DeLorean could be considered a prop on set, even though there are vehicle people on set, it's certainly a vehicle and probably there's a list to be done of movie vehicles. So I felt like let's narrow the scope and really go handheld props. And it took a lot of scrutiny, right? We couldn't have Freddy Krueger's bladed glove or Jason's hockey mask. Those are costume elements. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't have like Kermit the Frog. Yes, he's a prop, but he's like a living being in the context of Muppet movies. Say,
as a man who went to the alma mater of Jim Henson, if I saw Kermit the Frog as a prop, I would hurt someone. So yeah. Thank you for making that distinction.
And then personal preference. We wanted to create a very eclectic list that spanned all of movie history. You see, you know, we see Charlie Chaplin on this list, but you see Mean Girls on this list. You see all sorts of movies. And I think you could get bogged down very easily in ephemera from the 80s because it was so prop heavy and action movies, especially. There's so many guns. Sci-fi movies have so many guns and like weird tech. You could do a whole list of that. And we wanted it to be very eclectic. So it obviously took a while to come up with the list, and then having the motivation to actually, you know, execute this plan. It was my team at Thrillist plus some freelancers, and a lot of it ended up being me just making so many types of phone calls to pick up the slack on it. Everyone worked really hard, but because I'm obsessed with accomplishing this and getting a great story for every single prop, I found myself really consumed and trying any. It's a real detective work because, you know, a director, thanks to the magic of like IMDb Pro and publicists and my contacts, I could probably get in touch with a director of a movie a lot easier than I could a prop person or an art person on a movie, because they don't get interviewed very often and they don't need to be found. They have an agent who gets them work, and that's that. Or, you know, if I want to find the painter from Grand Budapest Hotel, the person who did Boy with Apple, like, where do you begin? I mean, I just have to keep searching and hoping that I can find someone. I got one of the craziest gets in the piece is the 90-year-old Chinese sword maker who made the Green Destiny from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. How did I get that person? There's no contact information as far as I could tell, because I do not speak Mandarin Chinese. I could not find any websites about him or having interviewed him, except for an Al Jazeera video report from like 7 years ago. And I actually contacted the journalist who did that and who forwarded me to his Chinese contact, who was like the translator on that shoot. And she got me in touch with the assistant of that sword maker, who's still making swords in China. He's 90 something years old. And she facilitated a brief interview with quotes from China. That's crazy. But that's like how much digging we had to do to kind of get everything we wanted for this piece. And it takes a long time.
No, it sounds like it.
It's a lot of freaking words. We basically published a book for some godforsaken reason. As people have told me, the piece takes a little while to load. It's like one of the rare websites or web pages that takes like – you did the right thing by reading each entry one at a time. People have been scrolling to number one to see what it is and breaking browsers. I mean, I can't help them, because in an era where like we complain about galleries and clicking one page at a time to read stuff, I mean, I just dumped it on this page. And
I was about to say, it's not even like split in half.
No, yeah, I don't have the tech. Oddly enough, I don't have the technology to create like a 5-page version of this article. It's very bizarre. But yeah, so I just dumped it on one page. I'm kind of like, I hope people enjoy this. I hope it doesn't destroy. I mean, if you try and read this on your phone, I don't know. You might be screwed.
It was difficult, I'll say that much, because I saw this when I was like right about to take a nap one day. As a working father, you know, when I get my nap time, it's time to take a nap. But I was just scrolling through Twitter before finally putting my phone down, and I saw this, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. I'll read the first couple. And I kind of, when something like that happens, I look for the page break, and I'm like, that's a good stopping point. And I got down to, like, number 64, and I was like, I don't think it's going to stop. I think I just need to put it down for now.
There you go.
Oh, my God. So, what... this is the problem I'm having, is that there's so much, and there's so many questions. So what was the spitballing session like? Like, did people have immediate ones and then it slowed down and you were struggling to complete the list, or was it like you had to cut it down from 1,000?
No, I think we were actually struggling to complete the list, because the top 20 were, I think, very obvious. We had to go with the lightsaber as number one. That's not a spoiler. I mean, if you ask, I tested this on my non-movie loving friends, you know, what's the greatest prop in movie history? It's got to be the lightsaber, right? Yeah, it really does, because it's everyone knows it. Everyone has seen this image and has had it burned into their brains, and it's just this dinky, camera Graflex handle that some set decorator found on a last-ditch effort to complete this project for George Lucas, and like that has stood the test of time. It's perfect, and obviously the like ILM additions to it are perfect, and that was easy. And you kind of backtrack from there. And again, we were trying to make this. We scoured world film and film from all decades, and I think what I learned doing this, because we wanted to make it so eclectic, it's interesting that American film especially has, and I haven't seen people, if people are subtweeting this list online, I haven't seen the criticisms against this lie too much. Maybe because they respect the fact that we got 100 reported stories and they don't want to just swipe me for kind of forgetting one or two things. But it's really, you don't find a lot of world film that has the kind of fetishization of prop work that we have in America. And I think, I mean, this is my own theorizing, that Hitchcock has a lot to do with why American film has a prop where we scrutinize props, we call them hero props, they're involved with the narrative stories that we tell because of this MacGuffin aspect. Mm-hmm. And kind of emphasizing what a prop can do and how materialistic we are as Americans, that we can be influenced and tugged and pulled by objects. And you don't see it so much in films from around the world because they're more concentrated on characters or everyday lives, the mundanity of the world. The best movies that I could think of from, you know, Asia, from Europe, from Africa, these films, they just are about experience and people, and they don't prioritize props in the same way. And they honestly, they aren't. They haven't transcended. If they, you know, we have Amelie's gnome on there because I really feel like that was a crossover around the world, and that gnome is so essential to the story. We did want to have legacy props on here, iconic props, and defining iconic as things that have connected with all sorts of people around the world and become emblems of those movies. So finding 100 is actually can be quite difficult if you want to be true to that definition, but also true to the pursuit of really combing through all of film history. It's difficult.
Now, this might just be me. I was a little surprised to see the lightsaber on there because I don't like, I guess I rarely think of a weapon as a prop, even though it certainly is. But like from a standpoint of length, the greater part of the lightsaber itself is like a special effect.
For sure, but isn't a special effect you're creating, that's still part of the prop.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, when I saw it, I was like, oh wow, I wouldn't have thought of that. And then thinking on it more, I was like chastened by my own mind to say, what the hell's wrong with you? Of course it's a prop.
Yeah, we have a few props that have special effects involved with them, and I think that's very key, that a prop is not just the physical make of that object that you shoot on set for one day. You know, we have the cup of water from Jurassic Park. The prop there is not just getting a cup of water. It's making the cup of water ripple on cue, which was a right. huge problem for them. They had to play Earth, Wind, and Fire at a certain angle to kind of ripple in the way that Spielberg wanted it. It's an insane story. Or you have the drill from Marathon Man. Okay, mm-hmm. The drill, getting the actual drill is easy. Finding the right sound effects to make that drill as excruciating as it looks is a difficult task. So
snitch. The snitch? That's what it's called, right? From Harry Potter?
Yeah. Realizing something that's been kind of created in the imaginations of so many people and have it do work and have it do faith. And then, again, then animate it, right? It has to come to life on screen through special effects.
I really love the Reese's Pieces one, which is with an ad or a ad executive, I believe, from Reese's at the time.
Yeah, he was the marketing guy who kind of bagged the deal, which was, you know, sure. You have to include something that's like product placement. There's two things that are practically product placement on there, but it's so important to Hollywood film. Why did you love that story?
Well, I loved it just because it was really interesting to get their perspective, how they were actually worried that, you know, Reese's would be put in a bad light. It, you know, a movie that's, you know, like, you know, a cause of celebration these days, like one of the most beloved films of all time. But I had forgotten that it was after 1941. So it's just like all of these little details entry that like really surprised me that gave you know, a very different perspective. But like along with that, I just was curious from a reporting perspective, did this kind of present a unique challenge in talking to some of these prop designers? Like, you know, as someone, you know, we talk about movies a lot, but props and set design is something that is like very secondary. So was it difficult?
Yeah, and I think that was a driving point of the piece, right? Where I tried to make the intro of this make this piece more relevant than even perhaps it is, but which is hard to admit. But I think it's a story about details. It's a story about learning every aspect and what goes into movie making, and at a time when we don't take knowledge of details as an essential part of living for some reason, that kind of investigating these stories and really learning what it takes to make a movie is important to kind of appreciating every aspect of the craft. Now, yeah, it's really difficult to find some of these people, and a lot of them are dead, right? So to talk about Citizen Kane Rosebud, the sled, like, where do you begin there? You basically pray that that someone had talked about it in the past, and we kind of lucked out because Orson Welles had issued like a press statement around the movie that we were able to dig up. If you ever want to get lost in like classic Hollywood history, go to archive.org, because they have all those magazines that were published between, you know, 1910 and 1960, these like Movie Story and Movie Talk and all these magazines that were published for the movie theater trades, because each movie theater was kind of run independently, and box office. Oh man, if you want to scour box office from that time, it's impossible because they weren't doing it as a national number. They were doing it by release, by theater. It's crazy. But anyway, Citizen Kane, Orson Welles issued statements about the sled and about the meaning. So we got a little bit there, and then thankfully, Google Books was a huge asset here. We were able to kind of dig through. I bought a lot of books, hardcover books. And went to the Performing Arts Library in New York City to kind of do research based on quotes I found in Google Books from old, you know, the making of Citizen Kane. And we found like the balsa wood specs for the sled. I had to go and like look it up in an actual book to get the full quote, because online can only give you so much. But a lot of Googling. It takes a lot of Googling. But you wouldn't believe that like the one that took the longest was Mean Girls and Time Bandits. Those were the two that I got the week before it went live. I mean, I spent months and months and months trying to do this and couldn't find anyone. And then all of a sudden, to get Time Bandits, I was emailing back and forth with a guy who used to make replica maps based on something, I hoped. So I reached out to him, and he had made contact with a designer who was uncredited on the film. He had worked on Brazil with Terry Gilliam, but because he was on another job at the time, he couldn't take credit for designing the Time Bandits map. So I would never have known that he was the creator of that map. So luckily, this guy had found him. He had done some of the work for me because he wanted to make pristine replica maps, which you can still buy on Etsy, by the way. They're amazing. But yeah, he did that legwork for me and put me in contact, and it was great. And then Mean Girls, it just doesn't make sense. The props guy on Mean Girls works. He just finished The Strain for FX. He works in Toronto. And director Mark Waters is so easily accessible. It doesn't make sense. It's just about time. It's about agents hooking you up and people having day jobs. You know, these prop people don't need to email me back. They have a living. Like, who cares? Who am I? Why am I cold calling people in Texas asking about, you know, the Burn book? That doesn't make any sense. Leave me alone. And luckily, I'm persuasive enough, or at least I beg hard enough to have people talk to me.
Now, what's the response been to this?
The response has been incredible. I mean, especially from a lot of the people who I worked with on the story. You have a prop guy by the name of Scott McGinnis, who was a huge help in connecting me with other prop people. Actually, he's worked on so many movies. He worked on Anchorman. He worked on Inception. He worked on Men in Black as an assistant props person, and kind of reaching him, he connected me to a few other people. And, you know, this article was like, people don't get this kind of praise in this industry. So I think you see a lot of them sharing it with each other and kind of basking in the glory. A concept designer named John Bell, who works at Industrial Light and Magic, he designed the hoverboard, and he sent me a little note just like he was brought to tears by this. It was amazing, you know, like all this work
that it has its own credits.
It does have its own credits. I was pushy about that. I felt like, well, we couldn't have a byline, so we had to have credits. It deserved it. I mean, it was a big, big production.
And so last week when we were talking about The Big Sick, We kind of bemoaned the fact that you can't get anything published, really, unless there's a news peg. So interesting thoughts and ideas will be tied very awkwardly to, like, a recent release movie. So in the creation of this prop list, was there ever a moment where someone tried to say, like, we need to wait for a movie with a cool prop in it to come out?
Or... Yeah, I thought this was going to be tied to The Force Awakens.
Ah.
For the lightsaber. I'm like, oh, that makes sense. We should do this. You know, the lightsaber is clearly going to be number one. So let's kind of put this up as testament to that. Plus 99 other props around the time of Force Awakens. Well, it didn't take me a month and a half to do it. So that didn't work out. And then another Star Wars movie came out. And then I still didn't have it done. And there were no lightsabers in that movie. So we just kind of put it up. I wanted to put it up before Game of Thrones. That was my new peg.
That's a decent peg.
That's pulling the curtain back on internet publishing a little bit. But I mean, it doesn't need a peg, right? Like, it is its own story, I hope. And and in the doldrums of summer, dog days of summer, I mean, we just wanted to get it out there as soon as it was done. Because when you live with something like this, it's I wasn't sleeping in the last month or so because I was so worried about getting these final props, making contact with people and hoping that I could get a story for each one.
It is a great reprieve from the deluge of D23 news that we're getting.
You guys are so cynical.
I'm a cynical ass man.
Brian and I definitely have a
sorry there wasn't any Marvel props on here. I thought about the Tesseract, but I just thought, eh.
No.
Nah.
What was I gonna say? Yeah, like, you know, everything I see is like, you know, Disney's doing this, Marvel's gonna do this. Here's a picture of some guy, and then in the middle of all that stands this monolithic work of like actual research and history and interest. And so, a nice breath of fresh air.
Although the hard thing is getting people to actually share it, because it's a lot easier to like go on social media and riff and joke about and share little details. And, you know, in these days when we have to kind of like, people should pass around stories they enjoy. I think that's important, especially if you're just a reader who's consuming this stuff for fun. It's actually very important for you to share and break up the news, which is so consuming, with some stuff that you really like.
This is true. And so in that spirit, anyone who doesn't know where to find this, it's on Thrillist.com. We will have a link to it in the notes for this episode and on.
Wait, I wanted to ask you guys what your favorite props were.
Okay. Michael, do you want to go first?
Well, I really like that ET one just cause that was a very different angle on what I expected. The Marathon Man story I found really interesting. As far as like my favorite prop, I really like that you guys put Monty Python using the coconut shells as and the story behind that. That's probably my favorite, honestly.
I got two answers. Well, first of all, I've got one answer that's not on the list. But this is only because I just watched the movie the other day. I am surprised in a slight way that the Polaroid camera from Memento wasn't on there. Because when I think of that movie, I think of Leonard like using that camera and how integral it is to the story, and then the fact that at one point he uses it as a weapon. So there's that. Now, my highbrow answer for favorite one that's on the list is the one that I thought would be first, which is the Maltese Falcon.
It's a top tenner. I think that's. I didn't realize that the Maltese Falcon had no origin story, or that the origin story was a mystery.
Yeah, I started reading it, and suddenly the Black Dahlia murder comes up. And I'm
like, yeah, that's a curveball.
Yeah, not what I was expecting. But you know, just in terms of, like you said, the fetishization of props, like that mm-hmm. feels to me like it's one of the first ones. It's like that. It literally, the movie is people willing to murder each other to get this prop. So that's my highbrow one. My lowbrow one is the brass balls from Glengarry Glen Ross.
It's such a good image. They really do look scrotum-ish and intense.
Every time I've seen that movie, I've had the question in my head of, like, are those a thing that he found somewhere? Like, are they a stress relief thing? Or in the world of this movie, did Alec Baldwin have so much money that he just created some brass balls to carry around with to make his point. It's
the latter.
Yeah. They're a gift from the sales gods.
From Mitch and Murray. Anyway, I used to be able to my shame, basically do his entire monologue. Only because I worked a lot of jobs that were not quite sales. And whenever people asked me like what my job was like, I would play them that monologue. So
always be closing, Brian.
Yeah, the second prize says steak knives. Third prize is you're fired. Anyway, so that's where I'm at with those. And then in my heart of hearts, I'll always be a little upset that the Polaroid camera wasn't on there.
Oh, I'm sorry. We had one Nolan.
You did.
We
had one. You had the top, though. Like, that's, yeah. You know, that seems obvious.
Hard to argue with that.
It is hard. It is extremely hard to argue with that.
Although the story is very, very funny about that. I did end up cutting a little bit of it, but for time's sake. But that Nolan had this idea for the top. And had like it just would never work. Like he gets lauded a lot for having all the ideas and like, oh, he's a visionary. And I truly think he is. And actually, I talked to his production designer a little bit too. That did not run in the article. That he was like, Nolan had a sketch, and that's exactly what we made. It was perfect. I'm like, okay. And then I talked to the prop guy, and he's like, yeah, Nolan had a sketch, and it would never spin. So we went completely back to the drawing boards and came up with lots of different top ideas, and then he picked one.
Talking about just impact, like after Inception came out, you know those websites where you can buy like nonsense, like basically the new sharper images of the world. Every single one of them had a different variation of that top. It was like a solid brass Inception top or a solid gold Inception top or like a set of four different metal Inception tops. And I was like,
now it would be a fidget spinner.
Ugh.
Bob's fidget spinner.
Oh, God. The fidget spinner. All right.
Don't get him started.
Okay. So, yes, again, that is on Thrillist.com, and we will have the link to that, both probably attached to the tweet that we sent out about this, as well as the page at thefilmstage.com where this is posted, and in the notes for this episode. Again, a shocking and at times overwhelming list, but well worth reading through, because it's just crazy. Like, for as much on this podcast as we talk about directors and writers and actors, and even producers, like, to see the work that goes into actually making the tactile world of these films is just overwhelming and awe-inspiring. As is the amount of work that went into the list itself. So thank you for sharing those stories with us.
Thanks for reading it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You couldn't stop me. It was eventually having to go to bed that finally did me in. So now that we've gone through that, it is time for the main event. It is time to talk about War for the Planet of the Apes. This is the newest film in the Planet of the Apes reboot series. This one directed by Matt Reeves, just like the last one. And it stars Andy Serkis and Woody Harrelson. And here is the trailer.
He's a smart one, isn't he? What are you gonna name him?
Do they look like just apes to you?
He saved our lives. He was remarkable.
You're him. You're Caesar. We've been searching for you for so long.
Tell your colonel we are not savages.
So that is the trailer for War for the Planet of the Apes. This film picks up some amount of time after the events of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and finds Caesar looking to lead his people out of the forest and through the desert to a better place for them to live. However, things go awry when the human military comes and sets Caesar on a quest for revenge against the mad colonel who is seeking to wipe out ape kind.
Yeah, you're the David of this podcast. Go.
All right, great. We didn't even have to get all the way to the end.
It just took that exasperated sigh for me to know. Anyway.
So it's just like, you know, sometimes you talk about a film and it's like, you know, a man returns home to deal with the death of his father. And then sometimes you have to talk about apes being murdered by the military and being Moses. So let's kick it off with our general thoughts on this film, but also with our thoughts on the previous two films. See what we thought of those, and see how this one stacks up. So Michael Snydell, since you had least amount to say during our last section, why don't you kick us off here and tell us, what did you think of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, either separately or together, and how you feel that War for the Planet of the Apes stacks up in this trilogy?
Okay, three reviews. Let's do this.
Brief reviews, Michael.
All right, so Rise and Dawn, I both quite liked. Rise is, you know, they're two very different animals in the sense that Rise is very campy, but, you know, has these moments that kind of transcend the camp, but also a lot of goofy moments. And Dawn was something that was really surprising in the sense of that it took that, you know, campy foundation and made something that felt very weighty and, was interested in things that I was not expecting for this franchise. And I liked Dawn. I haven't seen it in a few years. I couldn't actually bring myself to rewatch it yesterday because I just didn't really want to watch a depressing movie, but that's besides the point. War is admirable. War is ambitious. It's, you know, from purely like a design and thematic perspective, it's kind of amazing that this movie exists. From just the way that, you know, it's evoking like, you know, the past 50 plus years of war films and like, you know, but you can obviously tell I'm super good at articulating why. But War for the Planet of the Apes really didn't work for me, and I'm still kind of trying to figure out why, considering I did like Dawn, because it does seem like there's definitely a divide of people who, you know, maybe like Rise, but then really don't like Dawn and don't like this because it continues that very dour, heavy tone. But I think the difference here is that this one... or the last one, I should say, Dawn, very much put humans like on the periphery, and it worked really well for that in the sense that the main conflict was between Caesar and Koba, who was, you know, kind of tortured and part of a laboratory experiment, so he hated human beings. And that conflict was pretty interesting to me, partly because you just don't ever see movies that really put so much pathos in CG characters. And there's a really interesting discussion to be had about the fact that both of these blockbusters spend nearly 2.5 hours with mostly CG characters. But there is such a, there's such a weight of homage and a self-conscious like scope to this movie that just kept really rubbing me the wrong way. And I just think Reeves doesn't really have the right instincts to be able to meld tones, you know, when this tries for, you know, some brief comic relief, or the way that it tries to create allusions to things like Apocalypse Now and Schindler's List and Glory and, you know, this long lineage. But all of it just felt like... so much built on some very flimsy foundations, in the sense that this one again has a main conflict. It's with Woody Harrelson, but he is even more of a, like, has more of a stock motivation than what you expect from this movie. And it's an incredibly conceived movie. The motion capture is great, but this movie really did very little for me.
All right. Our guest, Matt Patches. What did you think of War for the Planet of the Apes?
Well, it sounds like, I don't think you're alone. I've been seeing a lot of people saying that they found that War for the Planet of the Apes is hackneyed. I went pretty swept up by it, I have to admit. And for some reason, I've gone into each of these Apes movies with severe trepidation. They all look bad. I don't know why. I don't think they're going to be good ever. And they always surpass my expectations, especially Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Just like, what is this movie? What's going to happen in it? It's not an action movie. It's really just about these performances and the kind of spectacle of bringing apes to life through CG. I just thought that was fascinating when I saw it and remember the ending kind of being clunky because I had to have an action beat at the Golden Gate Bridge. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I was kicked my ass again for the exact reasons you were detailing, like the Koba Caesar relationship I thought was really striking, and that, you know, ape do not kill ape, and kind of had to kill ape. They're going to survive, or if they're going to treat humans with some dignity and you know, level the playing field and continue on with both societies. And War for the Planet of the Apes is, you know, I've seen it knocked for being a very serious movie. Well, it's a pretty serious topic. It's about humanity being the worst thing that you can obtain. If Caesar can ward off becoming human, if he can keep morality intact and save his people, then maybe he can escape humanity itself becoming more human, and humans will eventually cannibalize themselves. It's disturbing, and the comedic relief is never quite comedic relief because it's also disturbing. You know, we meet Bad Ape, played by Steve Zahn, later in the film, who has been – he was kept up in a zoo, and he just went – crazy. I mean, he's we recognize this person in humanity too. People who've been cast aside during times of grief or disaster, and they lose their lives to these moments, and it's just so sad. And Caesar has the burden of being the leader for these people, and I felt that weight. I mean, Andy Serkis really brings something to the eyes of this these digital eyes to this character, and the subtle motions of contemplation. And again, this is not really an action movie. At the end, it must become that because humans, for all of they just can't stop blowing each other up. And it's just so true. I mean, the parallels are kind of obvious and on the nose. The Colonel, played by Woody Harrelson, is a nationalist, neo-Nazi, you know, military faction, hold up in a bunker with tons of weapons. And what does he want to build? A wall for? And it's that kind of blunt social satire that I think harkens back to the original 1968 Planet of the Apes and all of the subsequent sequels to that movie, which became more blunter and blunter. But I do think that Reeves has a control of this character. You mentioned kind of the throwback aspects of this, and it's definitely there. I mean, I think a lot of that has to do with Michael Giacchino, his score kind of injecting this kind of these classic war movie vibes, and Neo Marconi, especially Battle of Algiers, I kept thinking about while listening to this score play against the apes, you know, coming in factions into the camps or trying to bust out of jail. And I understand why that could be a criticism if it continually uses those references as a crutch, but it never felt that way to me because of the characters, because I found myself really investing in Caesar and the choices he has to make, putting his friends on the line or deciding to seek revenge, which he doesn't want to do. He knows this is the worst step he can make it's a step towards becoming human and these disgusting humans. And I think it's just a really important message right now. You can go too far. You can be too human for your own good at this point. It's a movie about empathy. And I think amazingly, the special effects have only strengthened over the years and captured that sense of empathy. It's wielding something that we see for blockbuster entertainment over and over and over again, bombast usually, for something really important and character driven.
All right, so now it's my turn. So I didn't like Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I didn't really like Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Part of my problem is that, like, To get a human to root against themselves as a species, you have to kind of like try to make every human either as cartoonishly evil or dumb as you can. And I think that that's a trap that these movies fell into a lot. When you literally have Draco Malfoy electrocuting an ape for fun.
I wish that felt cartoonish to me.
It's Maybe it's just because it's Draco Malfoy. Like, maybe if it had been...
I love that scene.
I hated it. I was like, this is, you know, to bananas, pun intended, I guess. And it's just, like... And then in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I really appreciated, like, the growing respect between Jason Clarke's character and Caesar and everything with Kerry Russell. Mm-hmm. But, like, I feel... And this might just be me being, like, an unevolved person, but I feel like not having a follow-through on the human story is a detriment to this series. Because it's, for me at least, really hard to tell the difference between these apes. They, in general, aside from, like, maybe two of them, seem pretty much the same to me. And so it's hard for me to look at them as a society, because really it's just like, here's a bunch of apes that are all the same, and there's one that's slightly different, and he's trying to lead them away. But, like, to what? For what end? Like, what is this utopia that they're trying to create? Like, they don't seem to have any goals or ambitions beyond survival, which is... a decent reason to do
I think anything. It's a pretty good goal. Persistence, yeah. Civilization, respect from the other people on this planet.
In Dawn, they had them kind of like running a school and doing some other stuff. I just feel like, aside from giving like one or two of the female apes braided hair, they don't really do anything to differentiate them. So when I'm watching these battle scenes, I'm not seeing... You know, even the slight amount of personality that, like, clothing or hairstyle would give someone. So it's just, it's harder for me to connect on an emotional level to...
I think you're experiencing what most people experience when they read and watch the news about conflicts overseas.
Yeah, which is... That's a good point.
And you're giving... And people... I mean, I think we bring the human story to these movies, personally. I know... how these humans are reacting to this conflict because I see it every day, unfortunately. And I know how we get to a guy like the Colonel because we're clearly there. You know, I just feel like we don't need that information. We need the other side of this story. We need the people who are like, how do we cope? How do we deal with this and survive and hold our morality and persist? I mean, how do we go about this without losing what makes us us?
Right,
Matt. I think the one thing though is that, like, if that was the case, I don't know why they then feel the need to rationalize. And I'm not going to be more specific than that because that would be spoilers. But there's something to be said if that character was meant to be like a primal personification of like a rational hatred. But they very much do want to humanize those characters. So it's like this weird in between.
But it's because that's true, right? Like we. You know, white nationalists in America don't feel this way because they're cartoonish villains. They actually have a motivation, and it would confound us to hear it come out of their mouths because we could step back and be like, well, that doesn't make any sense, and you would do this instead. But they're actually driven by these real feelings and this sharpened point of view on how the world should work or what they deserve. And the Colonel, when that all comes out, and maybe we'll get there in the spoiler section, but it all feels pretty real to me, except real life feels a lot less real these days.
Well, my issue is, and this is kind of like one of the reasons I hated Rise of the Planet of the Apes, and then especially... You know, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, I didn't hate it. I found it to be a lot more intellectually interesting than either Rise or War. I didn't like Rise because it ended with, like, a virus spreading around and killing everyone. Literally done over the credits. Not even, like, a post-credit scene, but just in the credits you learn that, like, everyone's dying. And
true to life, man. That's how we're going.
Is it true to life? I feel like that wouldn't be the post-credits. Unless you die and then you see credits.
You're supposed to watch Contagion right after this. That's
true.
What they don't tell you about.
There's a great infection movie.
Now, it jumps forward however many years, and there's that speech that Gary Oldman gives, and he says, you know, we spent like the first 10 years fighting like the virus, and then we spent another 5 years like fighting each other. And it's like... For me, at least, that's the movie that I'm, like, more interested in seeing.
You want to see that.
But, like, not only that, it's it's harder to, because we haven't seen that, and because we've spent so little time with the human characters, it's hard to know, like, what human society is like now when all we're seeing are these pockets of the military. So, like, there's never a clash of civilization or culture. It's always, like, this expeditionary force fringe of the military that they're clashing with in this movie.
Although War for the Planet of the Apes makes it clear that everything is just militarized, it seems like, at this point.
I don't know, because, like, they only talk about, like, calling... first of all, in post-apocalyptic world, why on earth would you go north? Especially when it appears that it's very cold at this particular time.
Well, it's probably getting pretty hot, you know. That's how things are... that's the direction. I'm moving north soon. I gotta stay cool, man.
But, like, when the world ends, my plan is to move south, because... I will not enjoy the heat, but I feel like I will survive the heat better than I'll survive cold. But we can save that for the podcast where we talk about our post-apocalypse plans.
Flat Earth.
But it's like, because in the last movie, we saw, like, people trying to set up a civilian civilization. So, like, is that just over now? Like, has everyone been conscripted into a military that's just...
or died?
Yeah, like, I don't know. And not only that, but it's... there's no reason for these two groups to continue to conflict with one another because everyone is dead. Like, there's so much space and so much resources that it feels weird that if we're really in, like, the ragged last stripe of our, you know, health as a species, that we'd be devoting this much.
I still feel like you're describing the real world right now. Like, why would we go to war right now?
We don't have to go to war, but we will go to war.
We will. This is just how the people act.
Right, but this is going to sound super odd, so I'm sorry about it, but, like, we can go to war because there's a McDonald's two blocks away and we have air conditioning. Like, there's nothing else for us to worry about, so we can do that if we want to. But, like, if there was a famine, then... we wouldn't, unless we were trying to get food from the country that we were invading. But in this world, the virus hasn't killed crops or animals. It's only killed people and made apes smart. And so,
but that seems just, like, that's their motivation. I mean, they make that pretty clear in War for the Planet of the Apes. It's like, we need to wipe you off the face of the planet because we can't have this going anymore. Like, we need to save who we have left by wiping you out. It's like all or nothing at this point.
We really only hear that from a crazy person. Like, I don't. Yeah. And again, if he is the last, if he is one of the 40 last people on Earth, then I guess that makes sense.
I mean, I don't want to get too spoilery, but we also have seen people not warring against the apes. Right.
In the previous film.
No, in this film, we know that there are factions of humanity that do not give a shit. And yet, it's the crazy people who continue to drag everyone back into war.
Right. Sure. Well, we might actually just want to get into spoilers. I will say that while the technology to create the apes is great, I feel like their integration into the real sets and with the real people was a little off from the previous two films.
Hmm. What scene comes to mind?
When he's on the horse and he's holding the gun, for some reason, like, he just did...
that could be a number of scenes.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think while they were at the beachside town, if I had to nail it down. And then when he is... this is a scene in the trailer, so it's not quite a spoiler, but when he is defiantly pressing his forehead against an executioner's gun, it just felt just the tiniest bit off. Like, in a video game, when there's, like, a little tiny bit of collision detection problem. And so it looks good, but there's enough for my brain to go, I don't think that those two things are actually in the same place. Now, however, their wet fur technology is, like, you could tell that at some point they're, like, some 20-year-old computer was jumped up and was like, holy God, I figured it out. Because there's a lot of waterfalls and rain in this movie. And those apes
and snow, yeah, the weather,
yeah,
and it's a big risk to actually put this little girl who they start calling Nova with these apes. I was pretty impressed by all the scenes of her, like, hugging Maurice and getting the flower from the gorilla and just like all that interaction. That's a big risk. I don't think I'm trying to remember from Dawn. I know that, you know, Jason Clark and his team, you know, meet up with the apes, but I mean, she's like clinging to them. She's part of their tribe now. And that's like a big technological step that we probably overlook and don't think of and how successful it is.
This is true. I also want to say, and this, I don't know if this is a controversial opinion yet, but I enjoyed Steve Zahn in this movie as a bad ape.
Me too. He could have been the Jar Jar Binks of this movie.
Yeah.
And he's not.
But he's not.
Thankfully.
And I think that part of that is, going back to what I was saying earlier, like I was happy to see another ape with like a completely different personality. Because a lot of them are like, their personality seems to be defined by nobly suffering, and he is crazy. And
there's a real heavy martyr complex in this movie.
Yeah. And but Steve Zahn's character is a little nuts and a little humorous, and like he doesn't know what to do. He's not like stoic and stolid like everyone else. He's more human. He's more real. He's got personality. And then of course I love Maurice too, because I don't know why, honestly. Maybe it's just
I love Maurice.
Yeah, Maurice is my favorite character.
And I think it's because of benevolence, and it's because of speaking with sign language, and this look on his face just I don't know, crushes me every time. Then he's consulting with Caesar, who I mean, his intelligence and his emotional spectrum is the risk, right? Like, it's good to be Maurice. Yeah. It's good to have this kind of like secondary step before evolution, that it's a burden for Caesar. And I like that dynamic a lot.
Yeah.
It's also just like, I said this, I guess I kind of said this already, but it's just incredible that this movie exists and that you're in a full, you know, multiplex where people are watching a movie where, you know, 75% of it could be sign language subtitles. You know, and it's, there's just a sense of like conception and composition to this that like isn't really there in most of what we expect from blockbusters. Like I like what this, you know, heralds for the future. It's just like you, Brian, I did feel that weird, you know, the uncanny valley. And it's weird when the movie is so, you know, fussily composed, and just the way that those backgrounds look, from the beaches to the snow, and then you have you know the monkeys. It's just like everything's just,
first of all, Michael,
in its
apes.
Right place. Sorry, the apes are there. Everything is in its right place, but there's just like something a little bit off, and I don't know whether that's just because I'm so used to blockbusters with, you know, actors who I can interpret exactly what's happening, you know, internally and externally, or if it's because I'm literally seeing, you know, a bug in the system.
All right. Well, let's get into spoilers, because I think being able to explicate our problems with the plot may be facilitated by being able to actually talk about the plot. So, spoilers for War for the Planet of the Apes. First of all, and this isn't really a spoiler, but I did want to talk about it. I love the fact that this movie goes back and tries to retroactively deal with everyone's complaint about how it should have been Dawn and then Rise by having title cards that use the words Rise and then Dawn, and then make sure to bold them, fill them red.
See? It made sense. Assholes.
Rise to a new civilization at the dawn of this. And it's just like, all right, you know what? You know what? Fine. Whatever. Now, so the marketing for this movie is super deceptive, because the monkeys are not at war. I'm sorry, the apes are not at war. We just had a whole VeggieTales song about this, and I'm still screwing it up. The apes are not part of the war. The apes are not going to war. The apes are not warring. The war that happens at the end is purely human versus human.
What? The first scene of the movie is the war of man and apes.
So going into this movie, did you believe that at the end, the snow battle that is like pimped in all the trailers would be purely human versus human? Or did you think that like the apes were gonna
No, the human adversary was a total surprise to me.
Yeah. But see, so like, but, and this is kind of the problem I have again, is like, the war is seemingly humans trying to kill the apes defending themselves, and then trying to run away. Which, like, is fine, I guess, but, like, it just, it's annoying to me that the apes have, like, no agency. That they're
no
just,
agency. They're rounded up and put in jail, and they break out of jail.
I would. Okay.
What do you want them to do?
Okay. So previous
and also Caesar.
Caesar
wants revenge, so that's agency as well.
That is an agency for an ape, but as a civilization, again, like they have no will. They're just like sitting there waiting to get abused before they can run away.
Every time you say apes in this conversation, I'm thinking Jews. So,
we can talk about that. But like, I mean,
but they do have agency. They live by a moral code that doesn't. They don't want to fight. They don't want to stoop to the human level. So they need to figure out ways to both thrive and survive without breaking that moral code that's been set by Caesar. It's a noble feat. They're not being, passive. They just don't subscribe to the militarization yet. The war that's happening in the first scene is all defensive. I mean, the men are intruding on their land and coming to kill them, and they must react. They're being forced to fight. But in these situations, especially when they're being oppressed in the way that they are, they're being enslaved and forced to not drink water and eat and build this wall. Like, what are they supposed to do?
That's a later thing that happens. Like, it's not like the soldiers are coming to catch them and round them up to use them as slave labor. Also,
wait, I thought that is what.
No,
not initially. They seem to just want to kill Caesar.
Oh, that's true.
Well, and then
it's a reveal. So I don't know.
I mean, if
well, remember, they have, the humans have gorillas, so they can round them up pretty easily. It's well, a good they so jump on that.
I wanted to bring that up. So there are these other apes that are known as the donkeys that are like basically defectors who have decided to work for the humans because
They're a bunch of turncoats.
Yeah, so apparently some of them were aligned with Koba, and now they're worried that Caesar's going to hurt them. So they decide to work for the humans, or they're like, the apes are never going to win this anyway, so maybe if I work with the humans, I'll be spared. It seemed that a disproportionate amount of gorillas were donkeys. So, within the ape community, is there, like, a problem? Like, are the cracks already beginning to show because the gorillas have less loyalty than chimps and orangutans?
I would have to rewatch Dawn to confirm this theory, but I would imagine that a lot of the gorillas were fighting alongside Koba for strength reasons, military reasons.
I watched some clips, and that does seem to be the case. But I think that does at least speak to something. Yeah, like I don't necessarily agree with you about the agency, Brian, but I think there is something to be said for the fact, like, that there's a lot of time that passes between these movies, and like that minutia is kind of what I want to know. Like, what does cause, you know, and maybe there's not enough for a movie there. Maybe I'm being unfair, but it's just like. It is. I am getting a feeling now from, especially as you think of, it's been 50 years since Rise, that there's a lot of stuff that's happening in between.
50 years?
That is the first. Yeah, I wrote it down in my notes. It is the first 50 years after Rise is my first note.
Oh, my God.
I'm reading that Andy Serkis said that it could be 5 years after.
I think 50. Okay. All right, guys.
Either way, it can't be five after Rise because I swear to God.
Is it five after Dawn, maybe?
Gary Oldman.
If it was 50 years, Caesar would be leading the apes in like a motorized wheelchair and,
well, I don't
and
know
spoon
what,
fed.
I don't know what a chimp's lifespan is, especially one that's been James Franco'd by some Alzheimer medicine.
That's true.
Okay, point being. Whether I'm completely inaccurate and can't read, the point being that, like, I think there is a lot of stuff that happens between these movies that is stuff I would like to see. And so the fact, like you, Brian, that when we're then concentrating on, like, a militarized, you know, extremist faction, I'm like, but this isn't really interesting. Like, it's not dramatically interesting to me. Like, it is something that is needed for, like, I'm feeling the weight of the need of the end of a trilogy and, like, the need to make something that feels really grand. But, like, but I'm also thinking in my head, like, this feels like it should be more transitional than it is. And I guess that's maybe just me, you know, like, rebelling against, you know, franchise concerns and needs and things. But there is still something where I'm like, yes, I know these characters, but I don't know them that well that all of these moments are going to weigh on me as much as they
should. I would agree with that. In the beginning, you don't feel like it's a last stand moment necessarily, especially because we don't see the apes rounded up by humans. I'd be curious if there's a scene on the cutting room floor about like how them from like the insurgency and then the, you know, diaspora trying to escape in the shadows of the night and then getting rounded up. That might be missing from this movie. But I'd say by the second half, I'm like, yeah, this is live or die. That's them or us. You know, this sucks for everyone involved, and hopefully they make it out alive.
Yeah. So first of all, to address the time frame. I'm looking at quotes from the Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. It's just Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. There's no definite article. So Dreyfus, who's Gary Oldman's character, says, "We've been through hell together. We spent 4 years fighting that virus and then another 4 fighting each other." So that's 8 years.
Where did I get 50? What the fuck?
I don't know. I really don't know. Is it maybe it was 15 and you transposed it in your
head? I was in the back of the theater.
Yeah, I don't know. But definitely, so it was definitely between Rise and then Dawn was 8 years. So it can't be 5 years unless it's 5 years between Dawn and War, which
15 would make sense.
15 years. Yeah.
Okay.
That sounds right.
I don't know. So that could be fine. Now what I was going to say is I hate being that guy who looks at a plot mechanic or like the minutiae of the story and says that doesn't make any sense.
You guys called me a computer last episode, so don't even.
On an emotional level, you are a computer, yes. But I had a real question about when the military found the apes that were running away, because it doesn't seem like that should be possible. Like, Caesar goes in an opposite direction of his people to find the military, and then
he was led there by deception. It was they convinced him to leave because the white gorilla was working with them. He fed them the bad information to draw them away so that they could intrude and get everyone, and then use that as a stake raising measure to lure Caesar back to the compound.
Maybe. Okay, because the way that it, in my head, the way it worked was, so they have the first skirmish. Winter lets other gorilla go because, again, all gorillas are treacherous, and then they get attacked. So Winter tells the colonel, "Hey, I know where they are." And then the colonel comes and kills Caesar's son and wife. And then it's kind of like they're leaving. Like, the colonel has to go north to his depot to go figure stuff out. But, like, the apes have already left their hideaway and are going somewhere else.
Right, so, but Caesar leaves them on information that he later gets from Winter after his family's kill.
Mm-hmm.
And then he meets Winter. But he meets Winter at that camp, and he shouldn't have gone there. He should have stuck with his people, I guess, is the implication.
Because the colonel says, "We just, like, ran across your tribe and, like, captured them all completely on accident." You know what I'm saying? Like, it seems as though, like, the colonel was already going somewhere else and just accidentally found this giant group of apes that should have been moving in the opposite direction.
I actually got that same sense as well.
Because, like, Winter betrayed them when the special forces came into the caverns to kill them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Caesar went looking for him and then killed Winter in the camp, but the colonel had already left that camp, and his people were already going away.
But they were going north, right?
I thought they were going across the mountains to the east.
Their compound is so wintry.
I need a map.
This movie should have come with a map. North. I guess that's the biggest problem.
The army was going north, definitely, but the apes were going over the mountains to the west, to the east, to cross the desert.
The real blame here is California, which is too diverse in its lush backgrounds, where it can have wintry mixes
so long, and I was just like, oh my god, are they still in California? Christ. But so my thing here, though, is that, like, again, the final war is between two factions of humans. And, Patches, you brought up, like, it's now the apes are just trying to escape and get away from these humans that are, like, trying to, like, destroy each other. Which is an interesting idea if it weren't for the fact that one side were clearly the good guys, because the other guy was, like, a murderous, genocidal maniac.
Right, but the implication is that all of humanity will eventually come for them, or that all of humanity is tainted and we're past the era of humans, that, like, they need to be wiped out Red Sea style in the end.
But when did we jump to that?
Right, like, that's my problem, is, like, we just kind of have to take the movie at its word for that. And, like,
we learn that through the personal struggle of Caesar. We don't have to see... We've seen humanity over the years through these movies, and we've seen the worst case scenario in the Colonel and his men. And there are people who work for the Colonel who are even skeptical, but they've gone along with it. And I think the assumption is, at a certain point, you will become that human if you are human, or if you are on this path where morality is already broken, then there's no hope for you. And that's Caesar's whole struggle. Can he be pure? And the you know, it's interesting, especially in considering the 1968 movie and how this one kind of lines up. You don't need to go into this movie knowing how it connects to the future, but it's interesting how it pivots from the apes are bad and they've become oppressors to humans, and look at this world that's been created, to these people are good, and that maybe they'll eventually be tainted by their continued existence as well. Like, just being alive long enough and being the ones in power will turn you into the humans in this case. So I don't know. They're good at the end of this movie. The apes are the superior race because they're pure, but maybe not for long.
First of all, let's...
the language here.
They're the superior race because they're pure is... I understand what you're saying, but wow. But I guess my problem is, again, like, in the first movie, you have James Franco and his dad, who are, like, good and decent men. And then in the second movie, you have Jason Clarke and Kerry Russell and their child, and other people also, who are, like, good and decent people.
Sure. So, like, Oldman's pretty irrational, though, isn't he? If I remember correctly,
I feel like he gets weirdly irrational.
He does get irrational, but he's motivated out of protecting humans, which is noble enough. I would contend with your assertion that Franco is just good. You know,
caused everything.
He caused this to happen, and if anything, these movies are an indictment of Silicon Valley disruption. Efforts are actually really terrible.
Apps will be the death of us. Planet of the apps. Which
self-driving cars are the new simian virus.
Oh my god!
I'm on my soapbox. I'm just wrong. But I mean, I do. This is about that gray area. What is good? What's bad? I think you're hitting the nail on the head in your criticism of the franchise, which is, like, all humans may be good on some level, but it doesn't matter because they've crossed the threshold of bad.
But
they're willing to make this experiment happen and ruin the world just to see if it could work.
But why tell stories about them then? Why not just make it the apes?
Because they're real. They're us. But they do drift. They do go full ape in this movie, right?
I hate this virus, in all honesty. I think it may be...
It's apocalypse now.
Perhaps the ape apocalypse now. The virus may be just a creative misstep that I am never going to be able to reconcile in this film. Because if you had just had the apes becoming super intelligent, and then that happens to coincide with, like, World War IV. Wait, why four? It would be three. We haven't had the third one yet, Brian.
It just feels like.
Or are we living it now? Yeah, I just don't know. So then that might have been fine. But the fact that you gave this virus that like wiped out people to kind of level the playing field off quicker and with no like moral gray area. And then the fact
it accelerates the timeline so that we can set these movies in now as opposed to the future. Yeah. That seems like a distant problem. But it also feels real because that's how Silicon Valley works. You know, our lives have changed in just 10 years since the like introduction of social media and Facebook and that sort of thing. Like, this is what really happens in the world.
Yeah, but I mean, usually it doesn't take the form of a simian flu. Usually, no. I say, because well,
you don't even know. It could be happening right now.
Yeah.
Chemtrails, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, God, chemtrails.
I'm joking.
So let me tell you how chemtrails fit into the flat earth theory.
Oh, no.
I really do have the fact that now, like, they've made the virus changing so that, like, it's making people basically devolve. Like, it feels like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but when I saw the Planet of the Apes for the first time, the impression that I got was, people had kind of like gone to war with themselves and everything, like society had collapsed. And then just over the course of time, apes mm-hmm. had evolved into the more superior species as man declined. And that's just what happened. Now, I'm sure in the following movies, they did some weird time travel stuff. But in the first movie, it really felt like it was just nature taking its course. But in this film, it does feel like they have had to artificially accelerate a lot of things and take a lot of shortcuts and create a lot of unbelievable characters and societal changes in order to make that happen faster.
And we haven't even talked about the fact that this is like multiple movies. Like, there's a huge, you know, prison escape in this movie and a concentration camp movie.
Tell you,
like, and
so here's the funny thing is, as negative as I have been on this movie, I think this is the most solid of the three films. Like, I think from a place of knowing what it's doing and executing it, and characters not making sudden like shifts in personality, like everyone in this movie is very consistent, and the movie itself doesn't ever feel like it dramatically shifts gears. Like, Gary Oldman's turn from doddering old grandpa who just wants power to I'm gonna fucking blow this place up, and Koba's like sudden murderous swing even didn't really play for me in Dawn. But in War, like, everyone's doing pretty much what I'd expect them to do. You know, if you get Marlon Brando's disease and become a crazy colonel, like, that's what you're just gonna do. And so even Woody Harrelson's like over the top madness played for me, and I think that like it's truly thrilling to watch the apes make their escape. But that
I think that's why I like Dawn so much more, though, is that like this felt so suffocating to me in not even giving those brief moments where you're getting, you don't even get those brief moments with the apes other than them reacting to trauma. Like I think of like one odd scene that keeps coming to mind in Dawn is, there's this scene where Koba tricks two humans who are on patrol by like acting like a monkey. And it's like, it's this weird, like, minute and a half scene. Then Koba kills him. But like, it's this scene that's this weird breathing room from the plot. And it like says something, and there's none of that in this movie for me. There's like little moments we talked about briefly, like where one of the gorillas gives Nova the flower, and there's little things, but those I just felt every time that we're preparing, like, and the fact that that character dies not 10 minutes later,
you can feel like the movie gearing up to kill him though.
It's just, it's this weird sense that, like, I understand that you guys have to get done a lot of different things, as you're saying, Brown, like that artificial acceleration. But I just want to, like, breathe for a little while and not constantly feel like everything I'm seeing is moving something forward.
Yeah.
And
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, Patches. So you're obviously the more positive of the three of us.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you feel about the like ending of this movie in terms of everything that happens after the battle is over, and then suddenly an avalanche happens. Like, did
I thought it was awesome. I thought I was like giddy. I mean, the biblical fuck you to humanity was a real. I was cheering. I was very happy.
I like that scene.
I just so love that it's like, oh wow, he's Moses. This is the Red Sea. This is classic Hollywood.
But Moses
reborn
made the Red Sea happen on purpose. You know, like one of my issues is that like the apes.
Well, that's because he was human and doesn't mind killing people. Caesar is.
I do
not
have a problem with the apes being that pure, though. Like, I really do. Like, I wish that they were grayer. I
you
wish
used
they
the
were
word monastic on Twitter, didn't you?
I called them forest monks.
Yeah.
They're suffering forest monks. And I just, like, I don't...
become that. Like, all civilizations start that way. You know, this is... It's almost like a throwback to the 2001 A Space Odyssey, right? There's nothing wrong with the apes... until the monolith comes, until it warps their society and they pick up the bone and be warriors and kill and take advantage.
But the apes in 2001 are still battling each other for like a scarce resource. It's just the monolith that gives them the idea to use the bone to murder, to like have a weapon, to be better at the thing that they were already doing.
Like, but they have that internal conflict. I mean, parenting is a conflict for them. How they should make decisions based on these outside conflicts. Humans are forcing them to go to war, so they must complicate and they must make moral decisions. But they're struggling to remain civilized. They're also on a path to where when Caesar dies, that likely dies with them. I mean, well, the nice is Nova is with them too, and maybe there can be understanding. But who knows? Like, it's an open-ended, it's an interesting, by tying it to the Bible, by tying it to perhaps diaspora of all kinds, you know that the future is not stable for them. There's not going to be hundreds and hundreds of years of bliss. Clearly, the Jewish people after Moses, it didn't get peachy, but... you know that at that moment they've accomplished something great, that they have freedom and they can walk away feeling good about this conflict because they haven't done anything wrong. They've just tried to survive. And that should be fulfilling on some level. It's a sad goodbye to humanity.
It's really not. It's not fulfilling. Like, I don't the fact that they're just like waiting for Caesar to save them, and then they get saved and then the mountain comes down. And these humans who were fighting to save like children and families are wiped out, and I'm supposed to feel good about it.
Well, are they fighting to wipe out? Well, some of them are. Some of them are under some of them are under the impression to do that. Others, but they've also aligned themselves with forces that kill people. They kill humans because they are disgraced by de-evolving.
That's the Colonel, though. The Colonel.
But yes, they're following the Colonel.
I'm fine with every one of the Colonel's followers dying. Don't get me wrong. But when the guys in white show up, they are the people who are literally there to stop like the rise of the Nazis. So it's like if a World War II movie ended with an avalanche wiping out the Allies.
But to end the World War II, we drop a nuke, right? So, and that is a complicated situation. Do we need to do that? Do we need to take militaristic force? I mean, those are the complicated moral questions that we ask in battle. And some people would indict the good guys for taking this kind of action. When the humans who are supposed to save the day come in, they're just blowing everything to smithereens. They don't care about that there might be apes there. There's no thought of what could be behind the walls of this fortress. They just need to destroy it. By destroying their own people, that's the end goal for them. But is that a good thing? Are they heroes for blowing everything out with huge helicopters? That's a good, I mean, it's the question that the movie raises.
I feel like that's a question you can get from the movie, but I'm not 100% sure that the movie itself is raising that question.
We don't see their faces, and I think that's important too, that like there's no one who's trying to negotiate with the Colonel. There's no one who's trying to like come in. There's no SEAL Team 6 to like come out in a mannered way and maybe save a few lives of the people who are, you know, not the Colonel. It's just brute force. And that seems to be the human way.
He seems to... this is, again, why I feel like the lacking the human story only helps to black and white this thing. Because the colonel says, like, they tried to talk me out of it, and I told them no, and I told them I'm not going to talk to them, and the only thing they can do is come here and stop me.
So, sure. Like,
if you have a guy who's going around murdering people who get sick, including children, like, his own men with families, like, defected, and he's like, and I went out and I killed them all. And then he said that, like, they sent a negotiation party, and I cut off all their heads. Like, this is a... I feel like those steps have been taken, but we're
here's
not
the
seeing
thing.
Them. Because the movie just wants to get to the climactic battle, and then...
But we've seen the aftermath. We've seen the aftermath. That's what we would see if we were watching the news. It's always about the aftermath. It's always about the inferences you can make. And it's like, for the colonel, he kills his own son because his son is a mute now, and he's become ape, and that's disgusting. He must... Mm-hmm. So the colonel kills his son because he is lesser than... He's not part of humanity anymore. His answer is to just kill. And then you have the northern troops who have watched this colonel devolve from sophisticated humanity or civilization. And what is their answer? They kill him. The colonel is the son of the northern troops, and they decide to kill. We should judge both of them for those decisions to do that. And the apes, of course, are caught in the middle.
But the problem is that his son, he says, when he held the gun to his son's head, the son had a look of, like, trust and love in his eyes. I don't think that if the colonel looked up into the eyes of the northern military, he would have trust and love.
Well, he didn't. They didn't get to that point because the colonel kills himself.
That's true. Now, that's the
in
other...
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's that, so that, like, you know, Caesar doesn't have to kill him because he's already dead.
We spend so much time on that conflict and that that relationship, and it like amounts to nothing. Like, it's a bold move to kill the colonel in the way they do, but it also just like, Brian, I'm with you. Like, I feel like that goes along with that ending
also,
too.
It should
there's
be noted
just
that
a...
we're not ganging up on an outsider because it's super rare that Michael and I agree on anything.
No, this is fun. This is why I like the movie. I mean, if I like the movie for any reason, it's because we can have these conversations about all the choices they make. For me, the colonel killing himself is a true moment. It's not a fulfilling moment for the blockbuster mechanics of a franchise trilogy ender, but it feels very true because after all this weighing his decision, will Caesar kill this guy and compromise himself, or will he walk away and probably get shot in the back by the colonel? See, it's almost like written in the stars that we just feel like this will happen. And yet they totally deflate the moment because at the end, this movie is about humanity being weak and ready to go extinct, and he has to kill himself.
But I think it would maybe it's just me and my crazy life, but like, I think it would have been more interesting if Caesar had gone up there and the colonel had already killed himself. And Caesar just...
I wish he wasn't infected. Yeah.
Caesar just had to live forever with the knowledge of, like, I could have done it. I didn't, and maybe I wouldn't have, but I didn't know. Also, this is again another kind of nitpicky thing, but like, that girl had a father on the beachside town who was fine. And it took all of 10 hours for the colonel to become completely lost.
What do you mean she was fine?
The father that was with that girl was fine. Like, he could still talk. He hadn't devolved at all. But and he obviously ran away from the military because his daughter was sick. But the colonel picks up like a single doll that girl has, and like 5 to 10 hours later is completely...
We're all genetically different.
I guess that's true. That's possible. And then Caesar, they leave after surviving the avalanche. And then they get to the lake on the edge of the desert after crossing a desert, and only then does someone realize that Caesar is bleeding to death. I don't know how long this journey was.
Sure. 40 days and 40 nights.
I was about to say, there were enough montage cuts that, like, I just assumed that everyone was like a couple of days worth. But so he's been driving for a couple weeks, and then finally he's like, oh, P.S., I got shot, and I'm ready to die. And he does. And actually, I really liked that ending, the him passing away just as soon as they get to this new place, because I feel like the odds are that they call this the end of the trilogy. I feel as though that's because now they got a new trilogy they're going to work on. I don't know that this is the end, that we're never going to see another mocap Planet of the Apes movie. And I think it's going to go along the same timeline, but I think that as far as an arc is a good one. And I'm actually interested to see like where it goes from here, because I think in that way they will actually start to set up a society and do more of the stuff that I think could have made it a little more interesting over the course of these last two movies.
Or we'll just get an astronaut in the next one.
Was I the only person who was holding their breath, hoping to God that like when it panned up into the sky,
you'd
see like a contrail of something?
I don't think you're the only one, but I hope you're the only one on this podcast.
Yeah, I did not want that. I was like frightened. I was horrified. I was like, yeah, I swear to God, if like it shows like an entry vehicle or something, I'm gonna scream.
That wouldn't have been enough time. They did that tease in Rise, right? That you see the space shuttle take off.
That's right.
So that's out there. That's out there somewhere. Floating in the ether. Yeah, I don't know. Again, like I really do wish that we had had like a human character to parallel along with Caesar.
Sure.
Because I do, you know, for all the interesting things that we've talked about, and this conversation has been interesting enough to justify to me why I went and saw this movie when I didn't like the other two and I was almost certain I wouldn't like this one. I think that the ideas that you can extrapolate from it and talk about it are really interesting, but I feel like it doesn't do enough evidentiary work for us to talk about it in any way but assumption and inference, and that is fun but not wholly constructive, because it really is hard to say like what humanity looks like now. Like, is mm-hmm. there somewhere else where like small town America has reconstituted itself into a multi-ethnic utopia and like everyone's fine because there are no guns and we just happen to have the military still being shit, but we don't know. Like, we know nothing about human civilization in this movie beyond that the virus has changed and now instead of killing people, it is eating away at their brain.
Yeah, humanity's over. Bring on the apes!
And I would argue we don't know that much about the ape civilization as well, in a way that I think we did in the last one. Like, you even think about the incorporation of guns. Mm-hmm. In a pivotal way in Dawn, and that like made sense that the apes like felt this new power that they never had. And I like in this one, it is very much like they are being herded wherever they're told, except for that, you know, first scene where they do fight back. It is odd that so much of this movie is like a waiting period to, you know, to then like become the engine for Caesar's revenge plot, which then like intersects again. Like it does feel oddly like, you know, reverse engineered at a certain point in the way that these threads need to connect.
Yeah. When Caesar arrived at that place and saw the apes on the St. Joseph's crosses, is that what those are? Or St. Andrew's? I can't remember. On the wooden X's, I was really expecting that to be like a completely different tribe of apes that he didn't know anything about.
I thought that as well, actually.
They sort of seeded that with Bad Ape, again, winningly played by Steve Zahn, and I was expecting Caesar to be like, oh my god, I was right, there are more apes, and I thought the end of the movie would be him, you know, becoming the messiah to these apes and then leading them to meet up with his old ape pals. I understand why they didn't do that. Now, you need to have that scene where he saves his son. Again, sure. A good scene. I enjoyed the whole breakout thing, but yeah, I don't know. I just like it's disappointing to me.
Didn't do it for you.
No. It's been like a theme this summer, though.
Same.
I've been super negative on a lot of stuff. The Big Sick I liked, but like the last movie I really like even enjoyed before that was like Wonder Woman. It's sad.
That was a while ago.
It was.
Welcome to the podcast, Matt.
I mean, what was before this? What was like the last movie that you really liked at theaters, Patches?
Well, I just saw Spider-Man again, and it's fun. It's just fun. I mean, I don't get a ton. I don't walk out with having this conversation about it.
Yeah, no, it's
definitely an improvement. I don't like the Guardians of the Galaxy movies at all.
Yeah, neither did I. So
that was a step up for me. I mean, I loved Alien Covenant. I thought it was awesome. And I probably love it for similar reasons to War for the Planet of the Apes, which winds up just being depleted, like Hollywood's depleted of director movies. Everything is a producer movie now, yeah. Which is fine. You know, Kevin Feige knows how to make a movie, and these other cats, you know, Lucasfilm and that sort of thing. But I just want to see a director go ape shit. And with and there's actual poop throwing in this movie. That's good.
Glad that we finally worked out
directorial vision. Yeah, you know, War for the Planet of the Apes has some beautiful shots. I mean, it looks really cool, and yeah, takes advantage of the motion capture in so many unique ways. And I thought Alien Covenant was equally explosive and audacious, and didn't make all the sense that it should have probably, but it was like it was throwing it up there. War for the Planet of the Apes, I like a little more than Alien Covenant.
I would say the same thing. I don't think I liked watching both those movies, but talking about them has been like some of the high points of my movie summer, just because of what you're allowed to talk about because of them. Like Spider-Man Homecoming was whatever, and there wasn't a lot to say about it beyond basic. It's a comic book movie, but these movies actually have ideas or the semblance of ideas that we can dig into, which is always nice. And the opening of this movie, I should have said, like the first scene is actually like really gorgeous and quiet, and I like the kind of shot that like shows you the back of everyone's helmet and has their different Vietnam style slogans written on them.
Bedtime for Bonzo.
That was great. All right, well that's the end of our discussion of War for the Planet of the Apes. Again, they called this like the trilogy capper and ender, but like they've got to make more of these, right? Are we just assuming that's going to happen, or do we really?
May not do that well. Who knows?
What was that?
They made $50 million already, I believe.
Oh wow!
I'm impressed we got this many of them. So
yeah, after Rise. Great. I was like shocked that it kept going because I didn't think that Rise had done that well. But apparently, you know, it's doing enough.
$56.5 million.
Is that a concept of how much it will make in total this weekend? No, or just through Saturday.
It sounds like through Saturday.
Damn. I don't know. Well, we may see another one of these soon. But that's all for us for today. Next week we'll be talking about Dunkirk. Possibly Valerian and a ghost story if we can get to it. Patches, have you seen Valerian?
I have not yet, unfortunately.
Are you looking forward to seeing Valerian?
I'm not as big of a Fifth Element fan or Lucy fan as some people are, so Luc Besson is not someone I'm like dying to see. When you get like $200 million to do whatever the hell you want, I'm kind of interested in that, so I might be. I've heard the middle is a bit of a slog, and then the beginning and end are inspirational. So I'm excited.
We're about on the same level for our Luc Besson feelings, so maybe we should have had you on for that one. We might have actually agreed a more harmonious time together.
Well, we don't need. I'm used to this. This is. I don't. I want this conflict. I want War for the Planet of the Apes. War on the podcast.
War over War for the Planet of the Apes. Yeah. So, am I still the David of the group? Has that been locked in?
You're not. The histrionics aren't there for you to be quiet.
No yelling this time. This is a weird episode.
Usually the yelling happens when like something crazy gets said. I feel like we kept a very logical, strong, grounded conversation.
Quite like the movie.
You're leading to the downfall of Western civilization. You should be ashamed.
Inside baseball on our own podcast.
Anyway, so yes, next week, definitely Dunkirk, maybe Valerian, and then definitely a ghost story whenever we all have a chance to see a ghost story.
Jeez.
I know. It's never
a Eraserhead too.
Yeah, we got to do a Eraserhead. Anyway, speaking of a Eraserhead, that's because we made enough on our Patreon that we are doing a classic movie review. If you would like to give to our Patreon to force us to do even more of those, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. You'll be given a chance to enter into our Slack channel where we can talk to our listeners live and in real time, and you will also be entered into a bunch of great movie raffles. So again, that's patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. We're also brought to you by Mubi, MUBI.com. Mubi has curators who select some of the best world cinema and independent cinema and all-around great cinema for your viewing pleasure. And every day they add a new film that lasts for 30 days, so you have a curated selection of 30 films constantly rotating through that you can take the opportunity to watch. You can download these to your mobile device, computer, iPhone, tablet, anything you like. They have a great Roku app, which I make use of on a near daily basis. All you have to do for your free 30-day trial is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you'll be given a free 30-day trial on us. Again, that is mubi.com/filmstage. That is it for today. Gentlemen, let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found between now and the next time. We'll also once more plug the Herculean list, the 100 greatest movie props over at thrillist.com. You can check out the notes and the page that this episode were posted on to see the link for that. Matt Patches, where can people find you between now and, well, no, you're not going to be on again next week, so I can't say that. Where can people find nope. you if they want to learn more about you?
They can follow me on Twitter at Mr. Patches. They can go read thrillist.com/entertainment, where most of the work I edit and oversee happens. They can listen to Fighting in the War Room, my podcast, and I think that's about it.
All right. Michael Snydell.
You can find me on Twitter at Snydell. And just to plug a few recent pieces, as I said before, I interviewed David Lowry about a ghost story. And I am currently writing a review for Chasing Coral, so that should be up this week.
All right. And you can find me writing for thefilmstage.com, my personal site, dearfilm.net. This week, I think, I will be announcing that thing that I teased last time, which should be... it's literally nothing related to movies, so most of you won't care, but it's pretty awesome for me, so I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to be talking about it a lot. In addition, once again, find us on iTunes, give us a comment and a rating. Please actually comment. The ratings are great. Love the ratings, but I like hearing from these people. So, once again, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to us, and tune in next week.